So, me and Cam.
You mean our secretary?
No, I mean the dark man that didn't look away. We can freely speculate about dark matter again. So this talk was very prepared in very much short notice. One of the speakers canceled apparently earlier in this week, so as an organizer, I had to volunteer to fill in. So the original title that I came up with was this: Triumph of Modifying Newtonian Dynamics and the Demise of the Dark Matter Paradigm, which is, I think, very much in the theme of the theme of this conference. But I thought maybe this title is a little bit premature and not very politically correct for this particular conference. Maybe the next one at PI, if you come up here, you can hear about this. So today I'll be more conservative and just talk about the good old cold dark matter that everybody in this room believes in. John isn't here yet, so I guess that's safe to say. So let's get started. So during the last talk, Mark and Mike did a very excellent job of presenting results of simulations and how theory could be wrong. All the analytic estimations are orders of magnitude off. So theorists cannot really be trusted with their intuition. You just go to simulations. So in this talk, I'm trying to do my best to cancel that or argue the reverse. And I don't say that theorists cannot be very stupid, but I'm saying there are ways to be more careful. So it's not that the only thing can be done on a computer. There are also things that can be done with pen and paper. Some of the part of the physics here probably sympathize with that. Okay. But before that, I need to make an announcement. So Chris yesterday showed this page from Wikipedia it's the page about known. So it's sharing the wisdom of Donald Rumsfeld. And in fact, this was traced back to the old Persian literature. This is a quote from a Persian poet. So this is the translation, which is now updated on Wikipedia, as you guys suggested. So the old translation was wrong. Now the new translation is here. You guys can use it confidently and trust the Persian translation. So what is the quote? For those of you who aren't here, just kind of repeat it quickly. One who knows and knows that he knows, his horse of wisdom will reach the skies. One who knows but doesn't know that he knows, he's fast asleep, so you should wake him up. One who doesn't know but knows that he doesn't know, his limping mule will eventually get him home. And one who doesn't know and doesn't know that he doesn't know, he will be eternally lost in his hopeless oblivion. So Chris already gave his opinion about which one of these is more similar to the status of dark matter research. So I decided that, okay, so if this is like dark matter physics, dark matter research, there must be analogies in physics or in cosmology for these other categories of knowledge as well. So I did some thinking, and so these are the best candidates I came up with. So for the first one, the people who know and know that they know. So this would be CMB physics. So they do excellent measurements, and they understand it as linear physics. So the horse of wisdom has already reached the skies, and there are cosmic variants limited, and so they got the whole sky to themselves. That's great. Good for them. So one who knows but doesn't know that he knows, that was the hardest one. So this is very personal and hard for me to tell you about this one, but anyway, this is the best thing I could come up with. So this is the status of dark energy research. That everybody says the dark energy is this big mystery, but then everybody finds that it's consistent with lambda, but they keep saying that it's the big mystery. So I think that's the best example of, so you should just go and wake them up and tell them that they already know what the answer is. Yeah, indeed. So the one who doesn't know but knows that he doesn't know, so I agree with Chris. So the status of dark matter research is very much like this. Particularly what I'm going to talk about is the status of dark matter substructure, how can we understand them, and how much it's relevant to dark matter detection experiments. So this is actually a very good example of a case when you know that you don't know something. So we know that these simulations, wonderful simulations that Mark showed us, as great as they are orders of magnitude away from the resolution that you need to explain any non-gravitational signature of dark matter being direct or non-direct. So you already know that you have a limping mule, but since you already know this, then there are ways of getting yourself home now that you have that knowledge. So extrapolation is the one that we heard about. The other one that I'm going to talk about is an alternative to simple extrapolation. So this is the best picture I found for a limping mule, which is not really limping. It's upside down, and it's not really mule. It's a donkey, but it's still. I think his eyes are. I don't think this is dead. So the easiest one to find was this last one who doesn't know and doesn't know that he doesn't know. And that was a string theory. And they will be eternally lost in their hopeless oblivion. So there isn't much we can do about that. So we're going to leave that alone for now. Okay, so let's move on. So these are my collaborators for the things that I'm going to talk about. So Roya Mahayayi, who we already talked about some of her work earlier. Mark talked about her work. Ed Berchinger, who's, I guess, some of her his earlier works we already talked about from 2 decades ago. Shant Bagram, who was a graduate student at Sharif University, actually saw her as a student, who's coming to Waterloo as a postdoc in the next couple of weeks. Catherine Zurich at Michigan, and Faber Kamia, who we're just getting started to work on this project. So there will be lots of interesting things from him that you're going to hear about in the next few years, hopefully. So let's get started. And please don't hesitate to interrupt me at any time. So cold dark matter. So this is kind of a redundant introduction, so I'm going to just go through it quickly. Because of their legal issues. For example, legally you're required to show a picture of a bullet cluster in any dark matter talk. So here you go, you see it, you know what it is. Dark matter is cold, that's the other important piece of information. And the reason is that this is the figure that you see. If you saw this, that meant that dark matter wasn't cold. So dark matter is cold, its temperature should be small. And so as far as the gravitational signatures of dark matter are concerned, basically these are the most, at least to first order, these are the most important pieces of information that you need. As Larry mentioned, it's cold, collisionless. So CDM actually stands for two things, really. It's collisionless and cold. Okay. And this is also an old plot about the prospects of detecting dark matter. So this was very optimistic, I think, or very probably a state of the field 3 years ago. Now this sounds a little more like wishful thinking. Maybe this is not going to happen, but who knows? Maybe Fermi is going to see stuff. The WMAP even had detected dark matter until last year. Now that's gone, unfortunately. Maybe Planck has already seen dark matter somehow, but maybe not. So anyway, I'm not going to talk much about the particle physics motivations, that why you're going to see the dark matter maybe in these experiments. But there are lots of people here who have already talked about them, and as you've all heard, the status of the field is very confused, to put it mildly. So this is one thing that wasn't really discussed, and it's even more futuristic than other methods of indirect detection. But it's the one that's closest to the heart of astronomers, as Larry mentioned, because astronomers love to talk about dynamics and velocities and stuff like that. And this is the one that is closest thing to what astronomers do. It can measure velocity of dark matter particles if these methods are ever successful. And in a sense, it's like having a dark matter telescope, because hopefully you can point things in different directions and see dark matter coming from different directions in the sky, the same way that you do with a telescope. Of course, we are far, far, far away from that ever happening. Yes?
Didn't the Hubble
But when I made this slide, which was a while ago, but if the,
okay. These are measurements.
Okay, so I have to update this slide. Well, this is a little bit more optimistic.
But is this something with this number that people are happier to agree with now? The community as a whole, is that 235? Is that a number that.
Plus minus what?
Yeah.
Plus minus 13, probably.
I'm not sure. It's a David Hogg, Joe Bovee paper, but I don't know if that's been accepted by the IAU or anything. It's the standard. 250, though, is probably too high.
It's too high, okay. So 250 is too. So what is the idea here? The idea is that solar system and Earth are moving in the Milky Way in some direction because Milky Way disk has some angular momentum, but dark matter, with the exclusion of what Mark discussed in the previous session, is expected to be more or less isotropic, doesn't have much angular momentum, maybe a little bit of it. So when you're moving with some velocity in this more or less static halo of dark matter, you have to see a wind, which is in the opposite direction to your motion, and this wind would come from the direction of constellation Cygnus. So if you have a directional dark matter detection, you're going to see all these tracks in your detector that are parallel to the direction of the Cygnus, or are actually peaked in that direction, I should say, more carefully. And that's very specific signal that would differentiate it from any other type of foregrounds that you may expect from Earth or from the Sun. Of course, there could be other foregrounds in the galaxy, but yeah, it's from the terrestrial and solar system foregrounds would be very different from this. That requires, of course, detecting dark matter. That's what you're waiting for. Okay, so the other important piece of information, and it's also obvious to most of you, I think, is that what we know about dark matter, and there's lots of observational evidence for dark matter, it has been for the last 50 years, but it's all based on this integral, which is a gravitational potential, which is a very smooth version of dark matter density. So you're convolving this density with some kernel. But all the direct detection or indirect detection, any non-gravitational experiment, is much more sensitive to local structure if they are there. So some of you, Mark, for example, argued that they are not there. But if they are there, direct detection is density at the solar system, which is very small scale. And annihilation is a square of density. So these are much more sensitive to the small scale structure that are not really proved by gravitational effects. At least not in any easy way. Of course, we heard a talk by Leo earlier yesterday, and he said that maybe you could see them with anomalous magnification. So wave detection is much more sensitive to dark matter substructure, and people often define this boost factor, and so this is the standard definition, is average of density squared divided by average of density squared. And I use a somewhat unconventional definition. I have a minus one here. But of course, the relationship is straightforward. You can add or subtract minus one. Now, the thing that everybody agrees, and I think maybe Joe Taylor was the first person to, James Taylor was the first person to point it out in 2003 that substructure in dark matter halos actually boosts the annihilation. So were you the first person to point it out? But Julio was your advisor, so I don't know. So anyway, I've told everybody around the board that you were the first person, so it better be. The thing that's not as much appreciated is that this same quantity also tells you the variance for dark matter direct detection. So, of course, for indirect detection, you have to average this quantity over the, I think this is dead. If there's anybody, well, actually I have this one. So for the indirect detection, you have to average this quantity over the volume that you're observing. So, for example, for Pamela, it would be a kiloparsec on Earth. for dark matter annihilation in a different galaxy. You have to average this over that galaxy. But for direct detection, you have to find this quantity at where the solar system is. But they actually, so this quantity is relevant for two reasons. One is for annihilation, but also for direct detection. Basically, if this quantity is large, that means that the substructure affects direct detection significantly, because this is the variance of density. So that's the thing that's not as much appreciated. So we're going to come back to this. And I think this was pointed out first by Widrow, Steve, and Freeman, which one of the authors is sitting here. You can guess them. Okay, so what about the hierarchy? Now, it's a bit redundant to show this slide. The reason I'm showing it is that I had this cool animation of ants moving, and the point of this slide is that dark matter particles are slower than ants. So this is another form of dark matter, but it's still warmer than dark matter particles. This other thing, I often ask people about it, but I think it's a bit embarrassing to ask this question. There is this interesting comparison between the phase space density at dark matter freezing for a standard beam scenario, which you can compare it with phase space density within our galaxy, which is mostly made out of dark matter, and you see that there is a 20 order of magnitude discrepancy between the two, at least in the standard beam scenario. And I often ask the audience why that is, but now I'm too embarrassed to ask that question. The answer to that, of course, by now everybody knows the reason between this, for this discrepancy, is that most of the phase space is empty. And it comes in form of sheets and streams that we just heard about in the previous session. But this is important, that whenever you make an approximation of a smooth phase space, you're really making a huge error by 20 orders of magnitude. Now, this error may or may not affect whatever observable you're interested in, but this is a huge approximation. You're replacing something that's 20 orders of magnitude bigger by this value, which is the Maxwellian halo. So this basically implies that this simple comparison tells you that there should be a lot of a structure. And here I say there should be a lot of a structure on all scales, because dark matter is essentially scale-free. So you would think that, okay, so maybe these are only a small scale, a structure, I don't care about this structure, even though most of the phase space must be empty, but maybe if I coarse grain on some scale, then it's going to be smooth. But since dark matter is scale-free, you're going to see these structures on all scales. There might be less or more of it depending on the situation, but it's not that if you coarse grain on some scale, the structure will go away. And obviously, Mark's simulations, they obviously showed some of these structures. Okay, so this is my cartoon simulation. But actually, this is a real simulation that I got from somewhere, I think from Roya. And this is my cartoon of how it looks like if you had an infinite resolution microscope and it kept zooming in. So you have these streams, and if each of these streams, and this is the phase space, so this would be velocity versus position. You zoom in on any of these arms or streams, you see other substreams. If you zoomed on them, you're going to see more substreams, and this will continue until you reach the velocity dispersion of dark matter. So it's not as fancy as the simulations of Mike and Mark, but it has the advantage that you can zoom in with infinite precision. Nobody got this. This is the cartoon. Yeah, so I'm saying that. So the cartoon has the advantage that you have infinite resolution. You can zoom in as much as you want. Yes. Good. Chris got it. That's good. So what types of, now that we know there must be a structure, we should see what type of a structure, or we can ask what type of a structure we should expect. And again, by now you've already heard the answer, so it's not going to come to you guys as a surprise. So there are three types of a structure. At least that's the way I like to think about it. So there are so-called bound subhalos, these are the things that people often talk about. For example, these are an old version of a lattice simulation that we already seen. And you see that there are these subhalos, and you can zoom in there, and there are more subhalos, and probably sub-subhalos, and so on. So these are tidally bound structures. They're not going to probably remain tidally bound forever, but they are there, and these are the kind of substructures that people often think about, and you can obviously see them in the simulations. More subtle types of substructures are the ones that we heard about, I think, maybe we heard Ming mentioned a few times. I think Larry mentioned them, and Mark and Mike mentioned them as well. This is not a dark matter simulation, but this is actual galaxy, an elliptical galaxy. These are known as shell galaxies, and you can see lots of them in the universe. It's NGC 3923. And what you see in these galaxies is that you see these shells. And the current thinking is that this is basically the remnant or tidal debris of another galaxy that came in here and was tidally stripped by the gravity of this big guy. And what you see is leftover of that. So these structures, unlike these guys, are not tidally bound. The reason you see them is that they were clustered in their initial conditions. Or another way of putting it, they were clusters in their integrals of motion. So this is a clustering in real and phase space, but this is clustering in the space of initial conditions or integrals of motion. And you see the same things, not surprisingly, in numerical simulations. I think James was a co-author on this paper, right, in Hayashi et al. Yes, okay. Yeah, so you just put in a satellite here, and you see it going around its pericenter, and every time it goes, it loses a lot of mass. And at the end of the day, there is some small tidally bound part, but there are all these guys that are obviously structured. You see these boundaries, these shells, similar to these ones. But they are not tidally bound. They're just clustered in their integrals of motion. So these are the two types of structures. So this is I would think this is the same as what Mike called debris flows. But there might be, one may come up in more technical definitions. What do you think? Do you think these are debris flows? This is basically what you showed, right? Yeah. So this part, so these are what Mike called the streams. And this is like a debris flow, but you don't see the streams anymore. Things are very much mixed. Of course, if you wait too long, I guess the mixing could go on, but you're going to still have this. You're going to still have these sharp features, at least in principle, I believe. So there is a third kind of a structure, which I'm not going to talk about, mainly because Mark Vogelsberger did already a wonderful job of doing that. This is what I call shot noise, in something as similar to shot noise in the phase space. And this is similar to galaxy shot noise in some sense. The reason for that, do I have a picture of it here? No, I don't have it. So that has to do with the fact that you really have a three-dimensional sheet that you're wrapping around itself. So you have a discrete number of streams at the end of the day. And there might be many of them. So as Mark mentioned, there are a million of them. But they are discrete. So these guys, they are essentially coarse-grained structure in this space of streams. But the fact is that it is a discrete space at the end of the day. There is a discrete number of streams. And if you have infinite resolution, say for these axion experiments, you might, then you're going to see this fundamental discreteness in the space of velocity. It's not very, very practical. But the fact is that this is there. And the reason people got this wrong was kind of a counting. So Sikivi had a lot of papers about this, saying that there must be 100 of these streams. And the reason he got it wrong, it was a simple reason. I think even a theorist can understand that. So he got the dimension wrong. So he did his calculations in one dimension, but we have three dimensions. So in fact, there are 100 cube streams, which is what Mark finds. So, and that's just a mismatch in the theoretical calculation that Sikivi had done and the real world, which is three-dimensional instead of one-dimensional. So, No, that's not. I'm serious. I'm dead serious. No, this is just a spherical car models work sometimes and don't work some other times. And this is an example. Exactly, spherical. That's what I mean by one-dimensional. Yeah. So as soon as you introduce it two other dimensions, then you just cube the number of streams, which is 100 cubed. Mark, do you agree with me? Yeah. So they were very symmetric. So that's why they constrained the number of strings was much fewer. So as soon as you introduce the symmetry, you could have crossing in multiple directions, not in just one. Really? 10 minutes. Okay. So I think the jokes should count as negative time. That's not fair. So here's, I guess, if you want to take away something from this talk, is that if you have a hierarchical structure, and this is a lesson we've already learned from cosmology, for example, for this clumpy, very interesting distribution of galaxy, one thing that cosmologists do is to calculate the correlation function, which tells us a lot, and you can compare it with predictions. So what I want to basically advocate and show you some predictions for is that you can do the same thing in the phase space, calculate correlation function in the phase space. And these are the kind of predictions that you get. Obviously, you can see these are theoretical predictions. There is no scatter, numerical scatter. But yeah, so this is what's gonna basically, that's gonna be the end of the talk. Well, hopefully, I'm gonna show you a couple of stars to argue where this comes from. But basically, there are these structures that I was telling you. You can see them in the correlation function in the phase space. So this is phase space correlation function, the same way that this guy was defined. I'm just defining it in the phase space at the position of Earth. And there are two types of correlations. There is one due to bound substructures, subhalos, which peaks at a very small differences in velocity. There is correlation that's due to unbound substructure or strings. And there would be something at zero, a delta function basically at zero, and that would be due to these fundamental streams. But of course, you're not going to see that here. And that's basically what I'm going to advertise as something that if you can calibrate it from theory or from simulations, you can answer a lot of questions that are interesting theoretically. So that's going to be the punchline. So the thing that I'm going to talk about in particular, advertise, is a theoretical approach to quantifying this correlation function for bound substructure. And the basic argument is that if you happen to have a very small subhalo, then it becomes resilient to tidal stripping. And that's basically the assumption. So this leads to what's been known for a long time in the literature as the stable clustering hypothesis, which says that the number of pairs at a small physical separation remains constant. At a small enough physical separation remains constant. So that's an assumption that, of course, needs to be tested, but it has very good theoretical underpinning just based on what I told you. I'm going to give you a couple of lines of derivation for where that comes from, but it's actually very straightforward. And all we did was to extend this to the phase space, and it extends trivially to the phase space. And the advantage of this is that, unlike the halo model, it captures the full hierarchy of a dark matter structure. So it includes subhalos, sub-subhalos, sub-sub-sub-subhalos, and so on. And there's much fewer parameters in it. Unlike the halo model, you have to specify the profile and the concentrations and the numbers and the mass function, all of that. As long as you are only interested in the correlation function in the phase space, there is essentially one free parameter that goes in this stable clustering approach. And here's the here's the two-line derivation. If you just do the simplest approach to tidal stripping or tidal effect on a subhalo, so this is known as the impulse approximation. It just tells that if you, the change in velocity is integral over time of the tidal field times delta x. And in the impulse approximation, you're assuming that delta x doesn't change. And this is usually an upper limit because delta x can change sign if you go, if things can move fast. So assuming that this delta x doesn't change is an upper limit on this on this delta b. And then you can separate this. This will be just delta x times integral dt Laplacian of phi because you're, so this off-diagonal component of di dj phi is of the order of Laplacian of phi. So that's order of magnitude assumption. And but from Poisson equation, we know this Laplacian of phi is just 4 pi, thank you, just 4 pi g rho. And we know that the density of halos drops as 1 over t squared, which is the density of the universe. So this is the finite integral. So there is an upper limit on how much velocity is injected onto halos, which is the constant times delta x. So if delta x goes to 0, this goes to 0. And this is a very, very conservative upper limit. So the heating at the centers of halos goes to 0. So that's basically. So this is the justification, or at least the heuristic justification of a stable cross-string. So what we are trying to do with Farbod, and it's very preliminary, is to try to look at phase space distribution phase space distribution in this the space of two-point correlation function of the phase space and see how it evolves with time. Anyway, so that's something that needs to be maybe justified more precisely, but you can already compare the predictions of this theory with simulations. So this is, again, Mike's simulation, and this is what I actually calibrated the stable clustering against. And this is the result for the boost factor. So the boost factor, you remember, it was just average of density squared divided by average density squared minus 1. And this is within the stable clustering approximation. And where this comes from is just a simple formula. It's actually probably too simple to be correct, but it's very simple nevertheless. And so what it tells you is that the boost in dark matter annihilation due to substructure over the whole halo, over the whole Milky Way galaxy, can be as big as 100, depending on the minimum mass of substructure. So this is the kind of minimum mass that you expect, for example, from Chris Sickerson's work. So you boost you in over the whole galaxy goes between 100 to 30, 40, depending on this cutoff. At the solar radius, again, this is just plugging from this simple formula, it's a smaller by a factor of 10. Did I say this right? It's a smaller by a factor of, a little bit more than factor of 10. It's about 30 or so. And it could be a few, so from 2 to a few. So this is obviously in contradiction with what Mark was saying. So I'm going to discuss that in the next 3 minutes, I guess. But so the nice thing about this formula is that it's all these weird assumptions about halo model and the profile of subhalo, how big they are, what is the inner crust, and so on. They are all replaced by this simple formula, which is just an integral over sigma of m, which is the linear over density, or a standard deviation of linear over density on a scale m. And so this is the local density of the halo, divided by 200 rho critical inverse. And this mu is the only calibration factor that's there. And that mu, I calibrated it to bilactate, it gives you 3%. And it's supposed to be the fraction of pairs that survive tidal stripping. So that's the physical interpretation of this. If all the pairs survive tidal stripping, all the pairs of particles, then this would be 1. But the one that fits the data is 3%. And yeah. So this is comparison to Mark's simulations to Aquarius, and it's okay, but not. But you can see there are deviations. So I guess you, Mark already showed this figure, did you? Or I'm not sure. Maybe you didn't. Okay, so this is annihilation as a function of radius, and this is the contribution of subhalos. And you cut subhalos at different masses, from 10 to the 5 solar mass to 10 to the 8 solar mass. So the jagged line is obviously simulation, and the non-jagged lines are the analytic calculations. So you see that there is more or less consistent scaling, not exactly, but more or less. And this is was calibrated to bioelective. I'm comparing it to a different simulation, and I think there was some discrepancy between the earlier bioelective and Aquarius. I'm not sure, is that still there? There was the number of substructure was somewhat different. Yeah. Okay. No. So this is the elective one. Although I mean it's just a number, so I can move this up and down. So that's the only thing that it does. Now, so this part. I think it's roughly in agreement. The weird thing is that this is falling off. Okay, so that's, I don't have much time, but so the weird thing is that this thing is falling off very fast, and that's because of basically the failure of stable clustering. So I cannot really use a stable clustering here, and the reason for that is what I was alluding to earlier in Mark's talk. It was that... All these guys that form at redshift of 30 or 40, they are now being tidally stripped here. They are not really there anymore. So a stable clustering doesn't work because everything is being tidally stripped. A stable clustering is based on the assumption that tidally stripping has stopped for very dense objects. So that's true for these guys. But we know the dark matter hierarchy goes to much, much lower masses. And in principle, the lower mass stuff formed earlier, they're denser. So they are not necessarily tidally stripped, even at a small radii here. So this, with massaging, with this tidally stripping, you can make these agree much better. But it's really a cheat because it's not really a stable clustering. It's just fitting a function. It's just coming up with a fitting function. I'm really out of time, but the really big, well, interesting conclusion from this is that there might be even an effect for direct detection, if you could believe this analysis, because the boost that I was telling you about is of order one, even at the solar radius. I think that's going to make Stacy happy. Tracy. Is she here? Oh, there you are. Good. Tracy happy, yeah. So it's hard to concentrate when you're in front of an audience. So anyway, so the fact that if you have boost of order one, that already tells you that you may see the substructure in direct detection experiments. Because basically within a period of 10 years, you're moving within these tiny objects because Earth is moving in the galaxy, so you may actually enter a substructure or leave a substructure. And this is, again, the two-point correlation function that you expect here for direct detection experiments. But, of course, to see this, you need tiny, tiny masses for the cutoffs for the dark matter hierarchy, like 10 to the minus 12 solar mass. So I'm really out of time. And let's see how much, Okay, I can show you, just flash the slide that I had for you before. So based on our calculations, you can, based on this stable clustering, you can calculate this two-point correlation function for bounded structure. And unbounded structure is a different calculation that I didn't tell you about. But then this is actually in agreement with what we already heard from Mike and Mark. Didn't say anything about summer flow enhancement. But basically this result says that there is about 10% fluctuations in phasor space density at a scale of delta V of 100 or so, which is what's already seen. I see that Jesus is rolling his eyes. I'm just going to skip. I think I'm really. Let me just go down here. So baryons, of course, are a big issue, but let's just end here. Okay, so there's, you can calculate boost in dark matter annihilation, time dependence in direct detectional signal and so on. And I think just when advertised, the correlation function in phase space is a really powerful tool. A lot of things that people are interested in can be calculated based on this instead of the Halo model, which is much more arbitrary. And that's it. Thank you.
Could you go back to the plot like that was similar to the spring et al. Plot?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that one.
Yes.
The next one, I guess, where you include. Mm-hmm. So even, I mean, you're going to get to a boost factor of few locally?
No, but that's the thing. This part, this is dominated by tidal stripping, basically. So I'm getting exactly what they get because I'm just making it, I'm fitting it this way. But yeah, so if you are in this regime, then the stable clustering is useless, right? So, but my point is that you're not necessarily in this regime if you have much smaller structures that are denser.
So your point in this plot is if it went to lower minimum masses, the spacing between the lines would start increasing, and you would reach the
exactly. So actually, this is more. So in my more naive thing, there is an exponential cutoff. Which is a bit naive, but I mean, it's just, I don't really know whether it is exponential or what it is. This is the power law. But the point is that, yeah, so here you're running out of the stuff because everything is being tidally stripped. So, yeah, so you see, obviously, the spacing gets very big here. I cannot really tell you exactly how it worked. That's, I guess, what Farber is going to figure out, hopefully. And the reason is that the stable clustering is based on the assumption that there is no tidally stripping. And the tidal stripping will cut things off, and that's the real issue here. So these guys are all being tidally stripped, but much smaller guys, like 10 to the minus 6 solar mass guys, they form much earlier, so they are denser. And they don't have to be tidally stripped. So that's the only issue that I'm bringing up. Yeah.
In this phase space stable clustering idea, if you want to test or compare with simulations, you have to be sure that simulations are actually following Liouville's theorem. Phase space densities are conserved, and
but I think it's the same. Well, I agree with you. It would be great if they are conserved, but I mean, this is a numerical issue like any other numerical issue that simulators have to deal with. You calculate it and compare it with what you, well, I plot it and then increase the resolution, see whether it changes. And,
apart from the, you have the 2-point phase space correlation function,
right.
But there's a 1-point correlation function, which should be conserved. That is, the phase space density.
Yeah.
And
no, obviously it's true. It should be conserved. If it's not conserved, then you're going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
And the question is, like, how much are you going to get it wrong? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I think the point is that nobody has really looked at this. Nobody has looked at correlation in the phase of space. So we don't really know whether or not numerical issues that is coming. But I agree that's a potentially one.